Not everyone's gonna get this.
Great morning, afternoon, or evening, wherever this conversation finds you. This is Gray Transforms. I am Travis Gray. Today we are transforming with Dr. Kyle Ortigo. Kyle is an author and a licensed psychologist. His latest book, Beyond the Narrow Life, a guide for psychedelic integration and existential exploration. Just a phenomenal book, like really great work done. If you are creating a psychedelic course of any sort, if you are interested in psychedelic integration, if you're interested in this area of study and experience and even beyond it, even more than it doesn't require you to have psychedelic experience with a substance necessarily to find a great immense value in this book. So that's this book, Beyond the Narrow Life. Just really incredible work. Thank you so much for what you have done to put this together, Kyle. How are you?
Thank you, Travis. I just want to say it's so uplifting, you know, as an author, as a creator of anything, to know how your work is received and that people are really deeply engaging with it. I'm sure that's an experience too, creating a podcast, but it's just really reinforcing for such a passion project, right?
Yeah.
That's really where the motivation starts. So yeah. I'm doing well today.
Awesome. I did hear you speak about the book and that you felt like it was a call. It was just it had to come out of you. If you don't have to do it, then don't. You know, if it's not just burning to get out of you, then don't do it. It is incredible to see such inspiring work that can be locked away in a lot of us that actually gets out. It actually gets expressed through you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a fascinating experience going through something like that too, because you can't really orchestrate it and plan for it. It has to be inspired, right? And it has to come at the right time, right place. And then in hindsight, you see, like for this book, for me, like, oh, all of my life was kind of preparing me for this, but it was not the plan, right, to write a book. But it's adds some of that mystery to the process of creating.
So when you eventually decided to write the book, from deciding to write it to the completion of this, how long did this take you? How long is this process? This is really... It has so much in it. I hope that everyone that is listening to this will get this book and see how much value is involved. Every section, every chapter has writing exercises, prompts. There's so much deep diving into one's self that you could do as a reader of this book. It's not just a textbook, or it's not just a biography. It is a deep exploration into these concepts, and then it becomes an experience of itself. It keeps the reader going to the next section because they are actually doing something with the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, to answer the first question, it was about 2 years from start to finish, and it was this initial experience. I was writing my first book, which I was co-authoring, and I realized, oh, I like writing a book. Hey, I have such a canvas to work with that's very different than a research article, for example. And so it came together pretty quickly, the structure of the book, the focus, the topics, as an opportunity to integrate a wide variety of my interests and experiences. But I always valued more active learning, where you're not just passively receiving information or being told what to believe, but really kind of wrestling with some of the ideas, thinking about how to apply them, and paying attention to your own inner experience and questions and sources of motivation and meaning. And so I wanted it to be active. And it needed to be active because it's so ambitious, because there are so many big ideas and concepts that I touch upon briefly, but I wanted to feel like there's a way to weave it into someone's personal experience in life. And a lot of these topics are things that a lot of us think about, reflect on, or get exposed to, but not all of it. And it can be helpful to just to take a different angle to bypass too, just the intellectualization, like a staying in the cognitive realm, to make it deeper and more personal. But I really dedicated those 2 years pretty much, for especially that last year, to developing it, refining it, using, you know, the different parts of our brains when we create something, the creative brainstorming, the like free flow state, and then the editor side coming in and having to switch back and forth between those different parts. That was a fascinating part of the experience when I was able to step back and reflect on just how different that journey was.
Yeah, I love hearing that because it makes me really reflect hard on my dissertation experience that is, is so challenging and so rewarding and so fulfilling. So my inner dissertation is always happening, and I imagine that experience happening through every you know, project that you're authoring or project that people set out to do. It is super fulfilling. You're discovering a lot about you're discovering a lot about yourself, because you are not just keeping all of that information intellectualized, you're organizing it in a way that can be articulated. And that's what makes writing so valuable. I think often people don't recognize the immense value in journaling or doing these exercises. And it's great that this book has all these journaling prompts, because when you organize those thoughts, they can be grabbed onto, they can be worked with, they become pliable. But when they are when they're just kind of like floating around in your head, they get lost in kind of like a muckiness, and they need to be brought down into like a grounded sphere. And this is how human beings have evolved over time. This is how intelligence has grown, is because we've written things down and we've articulated and organized these ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I, you know, one of my favorite analogies and metaphors for psychedelic integration work lately has been the process of translation, trying to translate things that by one of our definitions is ineffable, right? The inability to put into words, at least adequately, realizing that often still is part of the process of integration and applying some of these concepts, ideas, and experiences. And instead of just dismissing that language is not the full picture, abstract thinking is not the full picture, how can we use it while knowing full well it's not going to be perfect? No active translation is perfect. We have to make some choices and do near estimates and even creative choices in how we do that. But that's where the work really is. And there's a beauty in that I've just really appreciated that metaphor. But journaling is great. It's something I recommend, of course, to all my clients of a menu of options. But I know for a lot of folks, there can be like that editor side or that perfectionistic side coming as like, well, I'm not a good writer, or I don't know how to articulate this. And that really is the point of journaling. So you can just meander and go with stream of consciousness and not use formal English, have sentence stems and all of that, and just let it out, express it. And then over time, you'll find the narrative, you get to the place. So that's been important for me, and I think for others.
Yeah, I love that metaphor of translation, of translating your experience and translating your your experiences. It doesn't just have to be the psychedelic ones. It can be the experiences of your everyday life to just have a better grasp on what's going on. It's easy for us to allow our minds to run away with an idea without having, like, bringing it back to earth. Like, well, what actually happened here? If I write it down, I can edit it as much as I would like, which can be a valuable thing. But then it's also this is actually what happened, not this thing that I allowed my mind to spin away with. So, mm-hmm. So that's really important to me. I love the translation metaphor also, because it makes the experience, like a psychedelic experience, it makes it practical, makes it pragmatic. It's like, I've mentioned this before, and I find that there is a potential for abuse of psychedelic substances and just substances. Anything can be abused, but the abuse of psychedelic substances, I think sometimes that is happening due to it's due to a fetishizing of the substance rather than the experience. It's like the substance is a doorway to it gives you an opportunity to have this experience, and now the experience must be translated, the insight, the wisdom, the whatever is going to help your transformation continue to unfold, that is what is the real importance of having that in the first place. But in modern culture and like pop culture and different, you know, psychedelic culture, sometimes there's this shadow side of over fetishizing the substance, like, oh man, tabs of LSD or, you know, mushrooms and like things like this, but that's not really as valuable as the experience itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, focusing on like when my next journey is and when I'm going to get the next step in my process. And, you know, there are several people that have pointed to that phenomenon,
yeah.
Partly because we can recognize it in ourselves in different stages of our experience and journey. But, you know, this abstract theme of balance is always present in my mind, and it's a word really exploring in various contexts. But, you know, for people who are too grounded in earth or they're pragmatic, it can be helpful to shake that up and experience something that's beyond their concrete or very well-known experience of life and approach to life. And similarly, like, we can get lost in the clouds, and there can be a benefit of staying grounded and having some moments to put things into practice. So some of that is about personality and what we're going into life with. And a lot of it is just learning over time that all these different range of human experiences are valuable and can help each other. Like, being able to reflect on the cosmos, I start my book there, because psychology, none of my psychology classes started with that. So I was like, I'm going to bring this in because it's fascinating to me. And it sets the stage. It's the context of everything that we experience from what we know. Having that perspective of being able to go to the stars in our mind, our imagination, see that, and still come back to earth in our present moment and contemplate, like, well, what does that tell us? What can that offer us? And sometimes it shakes us out of our kind of rigidity and in some of the fear or even arrogance from the other angle about what's going on in life. And I think all of those things are highly valuable, but we need all these experiences and perspectives, I think, ideally, if they're available to us, so that we can stay informed, stay grounded, but still explore and get in touch with that sense of mystery.
Yeah, absolutely. What you're mentioning around the rigidness and when people get maybe almost too grounded, I don't know if I don't know if I resonate with the too grounded, but too rigid for sure. Too boxed into your own way of thinking. The studies clearly show around psychedelic use, substance use, that it does help helps the neural networks become more plastic. It becomes more malleable, and that is important. I mentioned as we were preparing for the conversation, I mentioned the work of Steven Taylor, and he I just had a podcast recently with him. So Steven Taylor, he had briefly touched on this concept that I've really resonated with and continued with, which is this homeostatic disruption. And so that that somebody that is really stuck in their rigidness maybe needs to be shaken up, maybe needs a sort of experience of homeostatic disruption. Their natural homeostasis needs to be disrupted experientially somehow. So the unfortunate truth of life is that sometimes we don't have the right container or we don't have the right tools, and some of these experiences become trauma, and the disruption becomes a wound to the homeostasis. But with the right container, the right facilitation, the right integration, the right tools, the right leaders, facilitators, this experience can be this homeostatic disruption can be a way to reintegrate a new way of being, a new integration. So I think that's all very valuable.
Yeah. And I think that phrase resonates. And I do think there are a few metaphors that kind of capture that. And one is the idea of a sacred circle or a mandala that Jung pointed to. And I use a metaphor too in my book, the idea of building cathedrals versus a house of cards. Like sometimes old systems have to fall apart, kind of unfortunately. It does involve some pain and distress, but so that something new can emerge and be built. And with the idea of that mandala, the sacred circle, and that there's a beauty in expanding that, like being able to incorporate more and more complexity and insight. And then also there's a necessity in life of being able to let go, the blowing away of the sand mandala. And that can be part of what we have to face in life. I think it always is, like facing mortality is one concrete example.
Yeah. Interesting thing about that is that we are very comfortable with our stuck rigidness, and so the pain is necessary for the growth. So it is necessary for when our old systems are deconstructed. It's necessary for us to experience this pain in order to, really appreciate this new birthing of a new way of being, a new way of experiencing life. The integration of the psychedelic experience. Do you think that there, I was going to ask this question like this. I think we're already tapping on it, but it's like, are there certain people, I guess that is what we're saying. Maybe somebody that is very rigid and in their stuckness, or maybe even in their unconscious stuckness, maybe they don't realize how rigid and boxed into their own perspectives that they are, or one-sided or things like this. Maybe that is the kind of person that should or that can be encouraged to see if the exploration of psychedelic substances is right for them. But in the integration, what What do you believe is the purpose of these psychedelic experiences? For me, when I was reading through the book and looking at the integration of these things, it seemed to me like fundamentally, maybe somebody is not happy with their current way of being or their current habits, or you know, just the current repetition compulsion that they find themselves in, and so they're looking for something like this big homeostatic disruption, this big experiential thing that will pull them away from that gravity that Sigmund Freud came up with, that repetition compulsion concept. So it's like we need something to pull us out of that gravity. And these big experiential events in our lives, like psychedelic substance. Do you think that there are certain people that should use psychedelic substances? I think this also runs parallel to one of the members on my dissertation committee. His name is Dr. Nick Fortino. That you actually there's something about yourself and him that have like a similar temperament, like the way you speak or something. Very cool guy. I think you guys would really resonate with research interests. But Nick Fortino has a podcast as well called Psychology Is, and his most recent guests have been psychiatrists and have been discussing this idea around, you know, do people actually he had the author of An Anatomy of an Epidemic on. The Anatomy of an Epidemic is a great book around psychiatry and drugs and kind of the problem of big pharma. But these, you know, they were arguing that maybe people don't really need psychiatric medications, but maybe some people it's helpful. Are there certain people that should, or is there certain things that you look for to give that sort of recommendation?
It's a really good and important question, because it's one that I think in the West, because these haven't been as integrated in our above ground settings, that we're wrestling with in our pre-existing models and ways of kind of categorizing people and their experiences, like in psychiatry and clinical psych, which I'm a part of, the diagnostic and statistical manual, like these disorders, that is that a good way of informing who could benefit from an experience, psychedelic assisted psychotherapy, which substance, why can they benefit? And it's not that straightforward, because nothing in life is. I appreciate acknowledging too that part of my first entries into this field and experiences was the thought that's pretty common of, oh gosh, everyone should have this experience. Everyone would benefit, right? And then over time, you realize that it's not quite that simple, because there's just such a range of experiences that people can have. And when you consider that most people are not going to have these experiences within a container, certainly within a psychotherapeutic container, or even a spiritual one, that diversity of experience and what people are coming into experience, what their life's like, what their psyche's like, and what they re-emerge into, like their pre-existing life, that there is a necessity of respecting the power and complexity of these things. All that said, a big part of the modern research is about how can we reduce any of the potential risk and help create that safe container, or another model, sacred container, so that people can have whatever experience comes up, and some views is like whatever experience they're meant to have, and have support before, during, and after to make some meaning out of it, to really capitalize on the opportunities after shaking that snow globe of being more mindful and intentional about how things settle afterwards. So I think, yes, it is a great medicine potentially, For people who come from a very kind of narrow-minded perspective or experience or feeling dissatisfied, that have lost that enchantment in life, that connection to mystery and possibility, and that this has the opportunity to open them up. But depending on the things that led to that kind of narrow or rigid perspective, it may mean that the experience is scary. It's opening up the emotional bandwidth from a narrower set to a wider set. And that's the emotions that are maybe more challenging for a person to experience, ranging from fear to sadness to anger, right? Depending on the person, to all the others of beauty, joy, possibility, wonder, awe. So being prepared for that, recognizing that, is so critical, because that may be the case for someone who's shut down, but it doesn't necessarily mean that's going to be therapeutic or helpful if they're not prepared for that. And they don't get, there's a model, internal family systems, where you have to get the buy-in and permission from these protector parts that have established this narrow bandwidth to allow some flexibility in even trying that, because it feels unsafe, right? It feels risky. So if we can do that very carefully and respecting these different motivations, then there's opportunity there for sure.
When you mentioned the model of sacred space, what do you think makes space sacred?
I would love to find the answer to that. You know, a lot of it does feel pretty intuitive. And I know in my work as a psychotherapist, there have been cases, even when I was in grad school, I was working on with one client in particular comes to mind, trauma history from childhood of neglect, some overuse of alcohol. This person was also becoming a researcher in some similar areas, and attachment issues came up, and really had some ruptures and repair cycles we had to go through in our work. We worked together for a couple of years. And at the very end of our treatment, we developed a very authentic, good relationship because of that, those cycles. And at the end of our treatment, and when I was going off, I think, to internship, she wrote me a letter, and she said something surprising in that letter. And it was that through our work, she felt like she rekindled her trust in God. And that wasn't the content of our work. Every now and then she'd bring up her faith, but it was happening in the background. It was happening in the context of our work together, our relationship. And so in hindsight, you know, that space was sacred for her. And so I've always, that was really touching for me to hear and to think about. So I've always thought about how, even when we may be doing things that don't seem like they fall within that line of spiritual, or this arbitrary divide of psychological and spiritual, that there may be an experience and process that's going on for a person that's deeply meaningful, that touches in those realms. And that connection, if not to God, then to like the cosmos, or to something that is ineffable, that feels grounding in a powerful way. So I think, you know, if I were to articulate some of the ingredients of a sacred space, it's authenticity, I think, is important, like transparency, really respecting the container aspect, that, you know, confidentiality can be really important in that, right? Having explicit conversations about that, demonstrating respect for each other, respect for the medicine, if it's in a medicine circle of some kind, for the psyche, possibility, and recognition of the unknown. Like, these things, I think, are part of the sacred container that come to mind right now, at least.
I had thought of sacred space with some of those same things. I'm big on the safety of the space. Explicit conversations on confidentiality is super important. authenticity, that this is going to be a space of honest engagement. That sort of is great foundational ingredients. For me, what sacred space meant is that you are the foundation of sacred space is to treat it as sacred. So you're treating it with the respect that it deserves. And then with that sort of perspective, everything can then become sacred space. You can live your life in sacred space. It is just about being aware enough, waking up to enough to treat that space as a sacred space, as a space that is meant to be respected, meant to be engaged with authentically, and meant to be safe. So those are great ingredients there. The more that I read the book, the more that this title opened up for me. And I love metaphor. I love like I'm Mr. Gray. So I'm like the gray thing is this like non-dual weaving thing for me. It has always become a very intentional piece of my unfolding narrative. I've been very fascinated, intrigued by mythology and narrative therapy and this idea of intentional authoring of our own stories and things. And so I've been very intentional to walk the walk in my own story. And so thinking about that, I like taking the symbolism and the metaphors and expanding on them. And it continued to deepen for me this beyond the narrow life. So beyond the narrow life, and you had just mentioned you had just mentioned something around that somebody maybe is looking into their, maybe they are in their rigidness are looking through this narrow lens and needing to, maybe they have a narrow bandwidth to a wider bandwidth you had just mentioned. So how did you come up with this title, Beyond the Narrow Life, and what does that mean for you?
Yeah, it's such a funny thing as a writer that, you know, it's like a 400 page book, I think. And the title was the hardest part in many ways for me. And actually what had happened as I had written out the outline, I had a working title for every chapter and tentative titles for the book. And my publisher that I ended up working with, they said, you know, we think the title for the final chapter should be the title for the book. And I was like, oh, of course, that makes so much sense, because it was where I was headed, like the final chapter. What was the motivation for me to write the book is to get to that place, for it to be a well-earned place, and that there are layers of that meaning, and there is enough ambiguity in the title to allow us to connect to different layers and parts of that meaning behind narrow, even life. But, you know, some of those layers I did touch upon, like the emotional range that we have, the experiential range that we have available to us, the sense of options in life in every moment, being more than we necessarily know and realize and accept day to day, from small decisions to large ones, and that we can increase our awareness of those possibilities and our tolerance of still that ambiguity of seeing all the possibilities, while feeling like we can make decisions that are guided by our sense of meaning and including our intuitive sense over time. But because we've opened up that bandwidth to take in more than before. So in many ways, it's about expanding consciousness, but in a relatively straightforward way, at least in theory and concept, of expanding our consciousness of things, our awareness of things and life, and embracing it all so that we can make choices that really do feel guided, not by some external factors only, but in conversation with our inner North Star, whatever that may be.
So as this title, I love the I love the discovery that, oh, what I was titling my last chapter is actually the title of the whole thing. It was where you were going the whole time. I love that discovery. I love like titles anyway. So it a really great one. And recently I had another podcast conversation with Javon Dangley. I could have mispronounced his name right now, but he works with Aleph Trust, and he did this transpersonal psychology coaching program. I originally met him in Prague in 2017 at a conference, and he has this concept of open awareness, and it came to him through the martial arts that was really fascinating to me. And this open awareness was the beyond the narrow life. Like it was sort of an antidote or a solution to so many things in one's life. And I find a lot of value in that. And then also there's this way that modern society and maybe just life in general has this way of fracturing and fragmenting our awareness, our mental space, our attention, especially modern times where information is so, like if you were scrolling through things, your brain is accessing big containers of information for each thing. Like you can imagine like, I'm doing this motion of scrolling, maybe like Instagram. So it's now Instagram, you run into my page, right? You run into Mr. Trav G or Gray Transforms. And then you are seeing, there's in the back of your mind, there's this whole story about who that is to you. What are other pieces of connecting information? And then the very next post does all of that all over again. Mm-hmm. And so your brain is like really worn out. The RAM gets very worn out. And that's why people have the and you have these dopamine spikes of doing that every time that happens, but then the brain gets very worn out physically, but also just consciously, psychologically, it's very worn out from doing that over and over and over. Over an hour of doing that, you could run into like so many different relationships and things, and it's fracturing, it's fragmenting your consciousness. So one of the defining factors of transpersonal psychology is that this is a holistic science, a whole person science. It's about being whole, being holy. And in the last chapter of your book, you speak about like this wholeness. And so, in coming into your wholeness, that is beyond the narrow life. There is not this narrow, you know, these guiders on, these like blinders on, rather. When we wake up in the morning, maybe we start out with our open awareness. And so that's what this gentleman spoke about, is that we're often, I'm just paying attention to you in this conversation, and I can't really see all the things that are happening around me. But if I open up my awareness, I actually feel a sense of a little bit more groundedness. And unfortunately, it wasn't until we started talking about this that I began thinking about that. So maybe I wasn't as grounded until right now in the conversation, you know, things like that. It's really fascinating. So really love the title and the metaphor of that. And I mentioned to you, I was particularly interested in chapter 7. And maybe I want to tie that beyond the narrow life into this chapter 7 is exploring meaning and the responsibility for making meaning, which I find super fascinating. And so far in our conversation, it's probably obvious the different things that I thought of that we've spoken about, that why that is so important, the responsibility to make meaning out of your life. That is a way of moving beyond that narrow life, which is really fascinating. And the responsibility of making meaning is super evident in the work of a very influential scholar in transpersonal psychology. He was an editor of the early Journal of Transpersonal Psychology, Viktor Frankl, who authored the book Man's Search for Meaning. It's an incredible book for anybody out there that wants to read. It is a book about his experience. Viktor Frankl is a psychiatrist at the time, a psychiatrist, psychologist, similar. At the time, he's a psychiatrist in concentration camps as a Jewish man. Viktor Frankl, I can only imagine how he remembered all of this information, and then what an incredible mind to have experienced these concentration camps. And then he developed logotherapy, and it was about the meaning that one makes to their life experiences being like of foundational importance to how we are moving beyond the narrow life, or how we are going to experience our life as whole. And I find it fascinating. And you brought up you brought him in for, you know, and it's man's search for meaning, that responsibility for meaning. Viktor Frankl found that the people that made meaning of their experience survived long enough for the Americans to free them from concentration camps. And that is just such a powerful real life symbolism that people should be aware of.
Yeah, and it highlights, I think, and some of these extreme examples, well, unfortunately not as extreme historically speaking for some folks, but these ways that we can face pain and suffering that is beyond our direct control. And how do we survive in those moments, or even find opportunities to still like express our values or our core sense of self in the face of that? And he talked about a few different ways that upon his reflection and work came out. And one was even, and it sounds basic, but it's not at all, adopting a remarkable attitude towards the unavoidable circumstances of life. That one's stood out to me a lot. And that's connecting to the meaning of that. Sometimes it's through a creative work, some sort of thing that we can leave behind after our own life. And it can take many different forms. And I've been struck by that, because that's a circumstance that I hope no one experiences again. But of course, even in this day and age, people are. But how can we learn from the people that have survived that to try to adopt some meaningful attitudes and connect to a sense of meaning and gratitude, frankly, even of the very small stuff that's very easy to take for granted in our day-to-day life? And that's for all of us to various extents, and why we have to step back a little bit to experience the gratitude versus the desire for things to be even better or more comfortable. But Frankl, you know, it was interesting. He first published that book anonymously. He didn't come out as being the author for that. And eventually he did with life, but his formulation of logotherapy and all these various forms of kind of existential, applied existential thinking, you know, they're acts of translation too. Like, how do we distill down this thing called life that we're trying to live individually and find our own way, but in a way of highlighting principles that may be helpful for other people in very different circumstances. And that's an ongoing project. So, you know, being able to, for me, to highlight and bring forward some of these voices and some of the people that have tried to point the way, as, you know, through their personal experience and as our history has evolved, we're hoping to do that for others in the future. Right. Yeah. We're all trying to figure this out as best we can and share what wisdom we can.
Yeah. Dr. Frankl said, despair is suffering without meaning. And he also said that the only freedom or the last freedom or the only freedom or like a base freedom that we have as human beings is to make meaning of our experiences. And so it's really a fascinating concept, and it does come up in psychedelic experiences. So in our psychedelic experience, it can really rupture us out of that narrow-mindedness, and then we can also get lost in that. I know from personal experience and the data around like the thematic exploration of certain substances seem to give people common experiences. And one with psilocybin, with mushrooms, it can give one the experience of contemplating death in a very real way. And even I've had experiences personally of looking at suicide. Not that I had suicidal intentions, but I began to understand why somebody would make that choice. And as, oh man, it's so heartbreaking. And man, it really fundamentally heartbreaking, but that somebody would make that choice. There is this existential threat of dissolution in a psychedelic experience. And that is a part of why it's so important to have the right container to you know, just the safety of that. Please don't just abuse these substances, willy nilly, like without intention, without a desired destination on the other side of that experience. The existential threat, there's a lot of wisdom that comes through in that.
Yeah. I mean, the confrontations with their own mortality. And, you know, in that chapter, I bring in Camus and that question of suicide and from a philosophical standpoint. And, you know, it was a choice that I really reflected a lot on because it was important in terms of the philosophical literature. But in modern psychology and psychotherapy, you know, there's a lot of attention for those of us that have done work with the range that clinical psychology encourages us to, like severe mental illness to actively suicidal people. I worked in an inpatient unit for several months. So seeing people in outpatient and patient settings that are really dealing with suicidality, if not having just survived a suicide attempt, there is, kind of these guidelines that we have to help people not commit suicide. And they're important because oftentimes it's impulsive or it's in the context of like heavy drinking or something else. But what I've found also being really helpful when working with people with any sort of suicidality is to out of curiosity, explore like, what is this a solution for? Is it a sense of pain or suffering? Often I feel it's a last ditch effort to exert an agency, some choice. Mm-hmm. And that is an opening in my experience to help someone explore, well, are there maybe more choices here than we see at this moment? And if so, what could guide these decisions about how to approach life or the circumstances that are causing suffering right now? And it's not in a Pollyannish way, but to reassert that this core question of one's personal sources of meaning and what can guide us in our life can be something we can reconnect to, rehabilitate, and see that it's beyond just the desire not to suffer, even though that's a fundamental one. Of course, we don't want to suffer, to have pain, and it is a part of living. So how can we not have a pain that is done to us, like expose ourselves to situations that's just going to be repeated? But when we recognize that there's discomfort, at least, that we experience, it's done because we're consciously making a choice to grow. And growth is a great example of that. It does involve a willingness, at least, to experience stress, if not pain, the full range of human emotion again. But to do so because it's in the service of increasing our understanding, our ability to live a life that we actually want to live, that we find value in.
I love that. Such a wise way to look at that experience of, this is the ultimate choice that could be made in this moment, and it can be made very abruptly. And I think that is, you know, extremely wise and speaks to your experience as a facilitator, as a clinician. It speaks to that experience that you hold, to be able to recognize that is not just a singular choice that is being looked at. It's an ultimatum of choice, but then there is a variety of other choices that can be made. And sometimes it's good to look at the bottom. This is the bottom. This is the last choice that could potentially be made. And so now, from the bottom up, now there's like all of this possibility, and that can be really encouraging. That can be really invigorating. And that can be the thing that gets you back up on the roller coaster of that experience also. So, so that's really fascinating. You said on page 187, you said each person must decide how to make life worth living in the face of this inescapable conflict. And I loved that sentence. So, it ties into this, You could think of suicide as an inescapable conflict if you were to make that choice, and how do you make meaning of that in a way that makes you that encourages you to make a different choice is really powerful. You also mentioned that meaning being the most essential psychological need, and that just ties into the Viktor Frankl as well. So I love where our conversation is there. But I want to ask you to open up a little bit on this concept of Jonah syndrome. So this idea that somebody would run away, and maybe suicide is this desire to run away from the goals and the things that you would want or be called to do. Like maybe somebody in the midst of writing their book or doing their dissertation, there's actually a sad statistic of like doctoral students, this getting getting your doctorate done can be a very pressure heavy task, pressure heavy program, and depending on what kind of school and program you're in, and all sorts of factors. But this idea of Jonah syndrome, that one would choose suicide or one would run away in some way. Can you unpack this Jonah syndrome for listeners? There's also another similar concept of repression of the sublime, which I think is kind of that narrow path, repression of the sublime. And Jonah syndrome is developed by Abraham Maslow. Abraham Maslow saw this story of Jonah and how that happens in our lives. Can you speak about that a little bit, Kyle?
Well, I really appreciated it as a concept, the Jonah complex, because what it articulates is, going back to the point I made earlier, living life through our values, sources of meaning, saying yes to that journey and all of its complexity, does come with it a sense of responsibility to do so. Once we've opened that Pandora's box of awareness and connection to that, and it also means that we will have to get outside of our comfort zone. And I'm speaking from personal experience. It's not that I wanted to write a book per se, or to give a lot of presentations, but I felt called to, so I needed to. The alternative path is to say no to that and to resist it. And there may be part of life where that is the case for an individual, but if that continues, then that can create and compound suffering. It doesn't get rid of that sense of responsibility or that desire underneath and to do something, but it suppresses it. And what Maslow articulated too, that in this complex, it can then get turned in and transformed into like hypercriticalness and dissatisfaction and hostility to others, especially to others who did say yes and took that risk and put themselves out there in whatever form that would be. And I thought that was so smart and helpful in a way to understand, like this idea that everybody is a critic, understand like the weight too of expressing our values and meaning and getting outside of our comfort zone, and how fundamentally that has to be despite how whatever it is received from the outside world. And that's feels impossible to us as social creatures, no matter how introverted or independent we are. To be able to bear that, reception of our work or our life, our choices, because these judgments exist. And this is a way of understanding for the person that does say yes, that, it's not about you, maybe. Maybe it's not about your work. It's about people's own journey and their willingness to if they think you could do better or there could be better, then for them to do it. That's the responsibility of criticism. Then do it yourself. And then that can help all of us if we continue to improve, because it's not up to just one of us as an individual, but it's a very individual path. And it's a leap of faith, I think, ultimately. So that's what I really appreciate about that concept.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's really interesting that's kind of like that could be the catalyst to jealousy. You know, that's the like somebody is jealous because there is something in their own lives that they are not doing, and they're seeing others doing those things, and then you become like a troll on Twitter or something like that. You know. thank you so much. I think we could continue to go in all kinds of great directions. I really was stoked about the chapter 7 and Rollo May and Aldous Huxley, and I use Rollo May in my own work around will and belief and love and will. It's a great book. This is an exceptional conversation around the existential concepts and psychedelics and how all of that can be weaved together and learned from. And I think that this conversation also shows that it doesn't require you to abuse the substance of psychedelics. You can totally be respecting of one person's choice to explore that substance. Our freedom of consciousness exploration, I think, is really important. And you could totally have respect for that, have respect for your own experiences in that. And It is not like the necessary thing to do. Also, there are other ways to find to explore these existential concepts, or explore how your life can move beyond the narrow life and be whole and have a wider ranging RAM and just to live a more authentic, actualized life in however that comes up for you as right for you, aligned with your North Star. So thank you again, Kyle, Dr. Ortigo. This is an incredible conversation. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
This was so fun. Yes, Travis, I really appreciate it too. And yeah, we could go on for hours with this, right?
Yeah, I know we can. I have other things. I had other comments. There is this wisdom, meaning, embracing our personal agency and power. This idea that science asks how more than why. It's conservative by design. Like the chapter 5 and 6 seemed. We had mentioned before the call the recording that you had mentioned the Tao Te Ching, and chapter 5 and 6. To me, I've been just recently exploring the Tao Te Ching more. And chapter 5 and 6 were specifically like more like to me very oriented to the Tao Te Ching, knowing death, knowing loneliness. So that could be a whole nother podcast. So I just encourage everybody to get the book then, so that you can explore these things. So
yeah,
thank you so much, Doctor.
You're very welcome. There's one thing that came to mind as you were sharing, and it's a client shared it with me, and it's the idea, this phrase, that Dharma is psychoactive. And I think we can rework it like podcasts, books are psychoactive.
Yeah.
Right. You don't need some exogenous substance to explore these concepts and these ideas. So I think we can trust that too.
Yeah, I love that. Dharma is psychoactive. That's really cool. Yeah. Thank you so much, Dr. Ortigo. In the description, everybody go follow that link to websites and books, find those things. And, I look forward, maybe we can have another conversation in the future.
Absolutely.
Hey, and I'm here in the Bay Area. We can get coffee, whatever you want. So
that sounds even better. Love cool. It. We'll do it.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You are the realest one you know. And if